June is Pride Month. Yet under Trump 2.0, LGBTQ people face renewed threats, from loss of health care funding to rollbacks in gender recognition. We'll hear from Equality California's Tom Timprano and Transgender Law Center's Shelby Chestnut on legal battles and grassroots action to secure queer rights. After that, anthropologist and former Los Padres hotshot firefighter Jordan Thomas joins us to discuss his book, When It All Burns, Fighting Fire in a Transformed World. Thomas offers an insider's account of megafires, their impact on crews, and the promise of traditional fire practices. And near the end of our hour, director Elena Oxman will talk about her debut film, Outer Lands, a story of survival, connection, and identity set in San Francisco. All that on State of the Bay. Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your guest host, Eric Jansen. This hour, we'll learn about fighting megafires from anthropologist and former firefighter Jordan Thomas. In his new book, When It All Burns, Fighting Fire in a Transformed World, Thomas shows how centuries of capitalist greed, genocide of indigenous people, and fire suppression turned wildfire into our enemy. He suggests a path to both reduce our risk and restore our partnership with flames. Later this hour, we'll hear about Outer Lands, a new film about queer resilience and self-acceptance set in San Francisco. But first, as Pride Month starts, tonight we turn our attention to the significant policy challenges facing LGBTQ plus Americans under the second Trump administration. While queer people are definitely no strangers to Trump's discrimination and misinformation, the attacks on their health, well-being, and safety have been unceasing since his return to office this January. Federal agencies are carrying out executive orders aimed at transgender and non-binary people, with policies impacting everything from passport access to health care and school sports. In response, activists, lawyers, and political leaders in the Bay Area and California are pushing back. Over the next quarter hour, we'll discuss the ongoing fight for LGBTQ plus equality with Shelby Chestnut, Executive Director of the Transgender Law Center, the largest national trans-led organization in the U.S. Welcome, Shelby.
Thanks for having me.
And Tom Timprano, Managing Director of Equality California, the nation's largest statewide LGBTQ plus civil rights organization. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Great to have you both. So on his first day back in office, President Trump ended federal recognition of transgender and non-binary identities, taking lots of things off of websites all over the federal government, and refused to issue a White House Pride Month proclamation. Numerous attacks against trans and other LGBTQ rights have followed. Tom Timprano, let me start with you. Give us a lay of the land. What are the broad categories in which Trump has threatened LGBTQ rights in his first few months in office?
Great question to start us off here. I mean, there are few, if any, areas where the Trump administration has not tried to interfere with the lives of LGBTQ people, dismantle key programs that serve our community, erase rights that we have spent decades fighting for and winning, all within a matter of months. I would say in terms of broad categories that the president has focused on, I think healthcare has been front and center. This administration has, from a policy and funding perspective, tried to take away access to healthcare, not just for transgender youth, but for all transgender people. The budget reconciliation bill that the House passed that the president supported threatens to claw back all federal funding for health care for trans folks across the country. He and his administration have also been very focused on rolling back policies that keep LGBTQ plus students safe in our schools. This is part of a broader attack on education in this country from this administration that folks may be familiar with, including the rollback of critical research funding, including funding that does research around LGBTQ plus issues. Of course, this administration has also tried to reinstitute a ban that the first Trump administration placed on patriotic transgender Americans serving in our armed forces. And the list really, really goes on and on, but a lot of focus on attacks on healthcare and education in the first handful of months of this administration.
Many of these attacks were outlined in Project 2025. So can you tell us more about what Project 2025 prescribed, especially in relation to queer rights?
Yeah, again, you know, these are sort of the categories that we hit on before. We knew their playbook before they even started running plays because of Project 2025. We knew that access to health care was going to come under attack. We knew that the attempts to erase LGBTQ plus students in our schools were front and center. You know, I think I speak for many, though, when I say that we were shocked with the speed with which this administration targeted the LGBTQ community and trans people in particular, issuing, you know, day one executive orders and in their first couple weeks, issuing nearly a half dozen executive orders specifically targeting LGBTQ plus and trans people. I think we were surprised, again, that there was this incredible outsized, nasty focus on attacking transgender people from a candidate that ran on fixing our economy, bringing down, you know, critical costs. And instead of actually focusing on those issues that matter to everyday Americans, this administration has spent incredible inordinate amounts of time and millions of taxpayer dollars attacking vulnerable members of our community, which I don't think even the folks who voted for him would want to see him focused on.
Okay, thank you so much. Shelby Chestnut, so many of the Trump administration's executive orders, as Tom just pointed out, have targeted transgender Americans. What do you see as the most significant threats to transgender people under this administration going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think first and foremost, we really have to change the narrative that the right is winning and that trans people are losing. I think with these incessant headlines, we're handing the Trump administration an unearned victory. The fact of the matter is that, you know, using the words of our beloved elder Miss Major, longtime Bay Area leader, trans people are still effing here. And we've always been here, and we're certainly not going anywhere. And I think under the first Trump administration, trans people were instrumental in resisting the administration's attempt to bully us from being ourselves. We launched the Protect Trans Health campaign, protecting trans people's access to health care. And we're continuing that fight now. TLC, alongside the ACLU and the ACLU of DC, are currently suing the Trump administration to challenge the withholding of gender-affirming care in federal prisons. You know, around the country, organizations are filing litigation, defending trans rights. And as we've historically seen, trans people are leading the fight against this administration's brazen attempt to divide us against one another. In December, at a rally following the oral arguments of the Scrimeti case, which we'll probably talk more about later, my colleague Mariah Moore said it best. We will continue to fight and we will continue to push back against harmful anti-trans legislation and any legislation that undermines the humanity of any human being. And I think in this moment, it's really calling all of us to stand together. And I think sort of what Tom's lifting up, that many of the people who maybe voted for Trump, I don't think that they're wanting to see that these harmful policies are enacted and harming poor communities, immigrant communities, trans communities, LGBT rights more broadly, that if we really stand together, that's what we need to do in this moment to defeat this harmful, harmful rhetoric that's being put on us.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think, you know, if we look back at how far we've come since Stonewall in 1969 and the Compton Cafeteria riots here in San Francisco before that, 1966, I believe, what LGBTQ rights that were gained in the last half century plus are still in place? What rights are safe for now, and so we can feel still good about having made some significant progress over the last half century plus? Go ahead.
Sorry, was that to me or Tom?
Yes, I'm sorry, to you. Go ahead, please, Shelby.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we're in a moment, too, where trans people are taking front stage in a way that we never have before. And I also think we're in a moment where a majority of Americans support transgender people. And I think, to me, what it is how do we start to integrate the rights of trans people in all aspects of society, not just like the LGB movement, not just the T movement, not just sort of our own issue as a standalone, but really trans people are embedded in all fabrics of society. And, you know, look at what's happening at the federal level with the House passing their big ugly bill, not their big beautiful bill, trying to restrict Medicare and Medicaid for trans people. But then you look at the ways that that's going to impact millions of Americans around the country who depend on life-saving health care that the government should be entitling their citizens to access. That it, to me, it's a moment where we look at the economic impacts that it's going to have on all communities, not just trans communities, but really all communities that rely on life-saving health care. And I think those are the entry points where when we start to overlay our rights as just the same rights that everyone else has, we start to realize that it seems a little incessant the ways that they're picking us off and wanting to make us a scapegoat for all of these things that have nothing to do with actually trans rights. It just has to do with human dignity and that we all belong in community and care for one another.
So I want to ask, that's a question I want to ask to both of you. It seems, is this informing your strategy and how you respond? For example, as you just said, trans people are the target out here, the visible target, but these changes in the big, beautiful, or big, ugly bill are affecting all kinds of people, especially based on economics. And related to that question, Supreme Court, you mentioned, Tom mentioned that you kind of knew their playbook from Project 2025, and did that inform your strategy on how to defend queer rights, knowing that you've kind of had a map? Whoever wants to jump in on that one first,
yeah,
that double question.
I mean, no, I think it's a great question. And I think for us at TLC, like, we have to take a moment and look at the gap between what this administration does versus what's actually going to go into effect. And with the Trump administration, the confusion is often the point. They're creating chaos by design. And at TLC, I think we've taken a stance that's like, we really need to take a moment. We need to take a breath. And that not every headline is telling the full story. And I think early reports, they're often containing errors, there's rumors, information is spreading online quickly. And I think for us, and I think it's some of the critical work that they're doing at Equality California and what Tom is talking about, is leaning into the trusted policy experts and the attorneys across the country are working as quickly as they can to interpret laws, to explain the laws to community, and also take legal action where we can to defend our rights. And I think while that uncertainty is hard for our community, I also think that we have to take a step back, take a beat, and remember that we've always had each other's backs, no matter what, whether we had no rights, limited rights, our rights are being taken away. But I also think that it's a moment where we as community really need to trust our gut, and that if something is feeling off for us, we need to call on each other and ask, like, hey, can you explain this to me? What does this actually mean? Like, can I still renew my passport? What do I need to know if I'm renewing my passport? I will say that there's so many resources out there for our community. You know, TLC has a legal services help desk where you can write in and request information. We've seen a dramatic increase in inquiries. I know another huge resource that's out there, I know a lot of folks have questions around identity documents. Lambda Legal at the national level has a great resource for identity documents, both state level and passports, that lean into what you do have access to before you just make the decision that you don't have any rights or that what's in the headlines is in fact going to change your access to access healthcare. We just know that that's not true, and we have to move away from, I think, that gut reaction.
Okay, very good. Thank you. You mentioned a moment ago, Shelby, the U.S., this case called U.S. versus Scrimeti. Tell us briefly, if you could, an overview of this case and what's at stake for trans rights in Tennessee and other states across the country.
Yeah, it's a really important case, and folks should definitely look into it and research more. So in December of 2024, the Supreme Court held oral arguments in the U.S. versus Scrimeti, a landmark case challenging Tennessee's categorical ban on gender-affirming hormone therapies for transgender youth on the grounds that the law violates the Equal Protections Clause in the U.S. Constitution by discriminating against on the basis of sex and transgender status. We're expecting a decision on that by the end of June. There will be rallies across the country. There will be major rallies in places like New York and D.C., regardless of the outcome. But I think for me, it's a moment, too, where across the country, regardless of any outcome, transgender community needs to come together and say that we have us, we've got us, we've always had us, and that the fight continues to be at the state level for transgender people of all ages, whether that's youth or adults, to access medical care. And people are doing that. I mean, Tom is doing tremendous work in California with Equality California and enshrining transgender rights and standing up to lawmakers that want to say that they shouldn't have the rights of transgender people.
Very good. I do want to kind of find out about California's advocacy scene. Tom Temprano, you're working directly with these things. I'd like your perspective on the Trump administration's threats to pull education funding and put huge sums at stake. Some estimates say California could lose over $16 billion for schools. What are the stakes here? What could be lost? And how is California fighting or preparing for that possibility?
Yeah, well, great question. And, you know, sort of as Shelby said, the Trump administration loves to talk. They love to announce a policy. They love to announce an investigation. And I think for those of us doing the work on the ground, we know that a lot of what we'll actually, what we're doing is actually fighting again in the courts and in our local state legislatures and even at the local level to buttress ourselves against the worst of what those attacks could be. In terms of what the administration has announced around various education funding, you know, this is, again, this sort of attempt to use transgender people and LGBTQ issues to distract from the issues that voters, again, including Trump voters, actually care about, like the horrible mishandling of the economy, like the fact that, and I like Shelby's, this big, ugly bill, they are potentially threatening to strip away health care and food access from millions of Californians and tens of millions of Americans. And so they like to announce a policy, send out a tweet, attack a trans athlete to distract from a lot of that. But in California, you know, obviously, should the federal government try to withhold federal education funding because of California's inclusive policies that support LGBTQ plus and trans students, it would harm all students. It would harm, you know, LGBTQ plus and all students in our schools. It would hurt our teachers. It would hurt our families. And it's just a very ugly, divisive set of politics that I think will be unpopular even with the president's base. So, of course, you know, our attorney general, our California Department of Education, our legislature are all working in real time to analyze what exactly these threats would mean, how we can fight back against them. And so, you know, like many things with the Trump administration, waiting to see what they actually do versus what they say they'll do. But we're ready to respond when we need to.
Okay. We have to wrap up in the next minute or so. If you could very quickly, both of you, how can listeners get involved? What should listeners watch for next, and how can they get involved? Shelby?
Sure.
Go
ahead, Shelby.
I think across the country and specifically in the Bay Area, there is tremendous trans organizing happening. Look it up. You know, get involved in the organizations that are on the front lines. Donate your time, donate your money, but also, you know, run for school boards, get involved in local politics. Even if you have a progressive candidate that's your representative, call them and tell them that you support transgender rights and that you think that kids should have access to health care. You think that they should play safely in school sports and that you're really as a concerned constituent behind their community 110%. It would make a difference for your lawmakers to hear from you right now.
Super. We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you both so much. That was Shelby Chestnut from the Transgender Law Center, and before that, Tom Temprano of Equality California. Keep your chins up. In about 25 minutes, we'll hear about Outer Lands, a new film about queer resilience and self-acceptance set in San Francisco. But we'll be right back after a short break with author Jordan Thomas on the sources of and potential solutions to megafires in California and beyond. Stay with us.
Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll meet Natalie Nakasi, the first Asian American head coach in the WNBA.
Wow, there's a lot of Asian Americans and even some girls that were, you know, Japanese American. And so it's special, especially when you can hear them say, you know, oh, I want to be like her.
It's episode 2 of Bounce, and we're talking to the boss. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your sonic scavenger. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm guest host Eric Jansen. I'm joined now by Jordan Thomas, an anthropologist and former Los Padres hotshot firefighter, whose new book, When It All Burns, Fighting Fire in a Transformed World, reveals what it's like to be on the front lines of megafires. Thomas argues that California's broken relationship with fire is rooted not only in climate change, but in a legacy of colonialism, corporate greed, and the outlawing of ages-old indigenous burning practices. He shows how the dramatic devastation we've witnessed in recent years is about more than just scorched land. It reflects broken relationships among our institutions, our communities, and the ecosystems we depend on, and the political power of the petrochemical industry and the logging industries. By weaving together personal experience, research, and cultural analysis, Thomas invites us to rethink fire as a partner rather than an enemy. Jordan Thomas, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Eric.
Absolutely, our pleasure. State of the Bay listeners, we're opening up the phone lines to hear from you. What do you want to know about fighting megafires? How have these fires affected you or your loved ones? What questions do you have? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send us a message on X at State of Bay, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Jordan, you began your career as an anthropologist before joining the Los Padres Hotshots. What drew you into the world of firefighting?
Yeah, you know, as an anthropologist, you get as close as you can to the object that you want to study. And I was trying to understand the human dimensions of the climate crisis, and fires just seemed like such a symbolic edge of the climate crisis. And there's no people, there's no group of people who are as close to these fires as the hotshots in California. They literally inhabit the edges of some of the largest fires in recorded history in these regions. So apprenticing under these people and working with these people was a way to really get to the edges of these fires and see what I could learn on these edges.
So it was kind of part of your anthropology field study. It wasn't like this is something you'd wanted to do all your life, was become a firefighter. Am I right?
No, actually, I grew up in a small town outside of Kansas City where I had really never encountered a fire in a landscape. And it wasn't until later on in some of my anthropological research in southern Mexico where I first learned that people have historically, and in a lot of parts of the world today, used fire as a way to tend to landscapes. So I had that in the back of my mind when I moved to California. And really, I just started off needing a job. So I started fighting fires with the Forest Service. And that's when I started hearing about the hot, because they're kind of local legends in a lot of parts of California, as I'm sure many listeners on here know.
Yeah. So
I
was just going to ask, for those who aren't familiar with the term, what is a hotshot crew?
Hotshot crew, they're like the special forces of wildland firefighters. And wildland firefighters are different from the firefighters we often think of because they don't use hoses to fight fires because they're fighting fires up in the mountains. So it's hard to get water up there. It's hard to get hoses up there. So what they do is they're fighting these fires with chainsaws and much tools like shovels and axes, because they're removing fuel from the edge of the fire to contain it. So you're creating like a dirt band around the length of the fire. And what this means pragmatically is that you need to have an incredible depth of knowledge about what fire is going to be able to do, to be able to live life so close to it. And you also have to be an extreme tactical athlete, because you're working, you're basically mountaineering with chainsaws and triple digit heat along the edges of these really intense flames.
Yeah, I just want to say, having read almost all the book, I would have to describe it as a bit of a political history and forestry science lesson mixed with a very riveting personal and scary adventure tale. So you have a passage in the book that really grabbed me, as many did, but it's, it's about what it's like being on the front lines. And I think you have it prepared to read from us. This is about if I'm not giving too much away, falling off a cliff with your chainsaw running in 123-degree weather in Big Sur. Can you read that section for us?
Yeah, I have it open right here. So by afternoon, I could feel my brain beginning to overheat.
My heart was racing like it was going to explode. My vision began to close, red shadows spreading from the edges until I was looking through a pinprick of blinding light. It took all of my focus to hold on to that light. I knew that if I allowed it to close, I would be finished. I would pass out. If I survived, I would wake up in a private medical helicopter. I could not afford the flight. The light was what was keeping me conscious, so I focused on it with all my will, relegating the chainsaw to the instincts of my body. My work became sloppy. My chain was dull, making each cut more difficult. I killed the engine, dropped to my knees, and opened the chainsaw with a wrench to swap out the chain. Edgar watched from above, perched on a sandstone protrusion like an overlord. The only thing I could smell was gasoline. I blistered my thumb against the chainsaw through a hole I had worn in my leather glove. Sweat dribbled from my chin and sizzled against the metal. One drop, then another. I wasn't sweating enough. Chills crept along my skin. Some corner of my mind that hadn't yet fried whispered that these were signs of an impending heat stroke. I was too tired to feel afraid. Too hot. I moved mechanically, still on my knees, pulling a canteen of water from my pack and dumping it on my head. I almost cried out. Maybe I whimpered. The water pouring down my back was the temperature of the air, nearly hot enough to scald me. I stood. My vision was a throbbing mass of black and red, closing around at the last point of light. I focused on that point of light. Stay conscious. The chainsaw was screaming again. I must have turned it on. Life was crashing around me, wood and wax and leaves and the last salt for my own body. Eventually, I couldn't hear through the pounding of my pulse, couldn't feel the sticks and twigs cutting into my skin, could no longer feel my own body. I cut a low stump, chainsaw teeth zipping inches from my boot. That's all it would take, a little voice whispered inside my head. Just one nick. At this point, I wouldn't even feel it. My body was far past the realm of sensation. Just one toe. Just take one toe. Then this will all be over. I had blacked out. When the pinprick of light opened again, I was standing, my legs wobbling like jelly, cutting a rock at full tilt on the edge of a small cliff. Stone on metal, sparks flying. I didn't worry about the sparks. The chain was ruined. This jolted me back to my body. Edgar was watching. If he saw me swap another chain, he would be angry. I couldn't handle his shouting. Not now. I would break. Before I could regroup, the rocks moved under my feet. My balance had fled long ago. The ground beneath me disappeared. I heard Smitty shout in the distance, but I was already in the air, body limp, plummeting with my chainsaw down the cliff.
Yeah, that's quite, you know, adrenaline-inducing just to read it.
Yeah.
And yet you survived to tell about it. So before we go, how did you survive that fall?
Well, so I survived that because I hit the chain break, so I didn't cut myself while I was falling, thank goodness. But I think it's just important to really recognize that what I'm trying to do here is give climate change a location and help people feel it, because it's so often framed as some future phenomenon or abstract phenomenon or something happening elsewhere. But I mean, that day it was a heat dome along the West Coast, and hundreds of people died in cities across the West Coast. And by putting it in my own body there and in the body of my crew as we're on this fire, I think it really just brings out how climate change is violence, and it's not just happening passively, but it's being inflicted by people in the fossil fuel industry and people in our political offices who are enabling them. And this really, in this book, is what I'm this ties into how I'm trying to frame fires, not just as natural disasters, but as political choices that people are making and that we can hold them account for.
Right. Absolutely. I want to let people know that we're talking to Jordan Thomas, the author of When It All Burns. We'd love to have you join us with your questions, or you can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org, or find us on social media, Blue Sky, Instagram, and more. I just want to read the one little section right after that. You give some context to this. You said, as my body collapsed on that ridge, the heat was causing power cables to melt and roads to buckle all along the West Coast. In cities, paramedics ran out of cooling stations, so they resorted to filling body bags meant for cadavers with ice, then zipping unconscious victims of heat stroke inside. When people collapsed on sidewalks, they suffered third-degree burns. In hospital records, the medical thermometers designed to read the body temperatures of victims all came out at 107 degrees, which was mysterious until doctors realized that the instruments weren't designed to go any higher. Yeah, this is part... And you after that, you get into definitely some, I think, legitimate anger at the fossil fuel industry and how they went through a practice of climate change denial. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So climate change denial, as I think anybody in America would understand, has been prominent for a couple of decades now. I think what people weren't so aware of until recently, when a bunch of documents have come out in recent court cases, was that the fossil fuel industry really knew about the effects that climate change would have since about the 1960s. And they covered it up very similarly to how the tobacco industry covered up the health effects of tobacco and cigarette smoking, which they're more or less held to account for in the 1990s. So this is not new. This is the denialism was part of a political strategy to maintain fossil fuel profits at the expense of everybody else. And it leads to situations like this, where there are people like firefighters out on ridges, like the people I worked with and many people around the world and other sorts of jobs who are doing jobs that are essential for society, while they're facing increasingly violent conditions because of the actions of a handful of very wealthy people who make decisions in air-conditioned rooms.
Mm-hmm. There's a section where you mentioned where some of these denial strategies started, or actually, I should back up even farther. In 1958, you mentioned that the head of the then Humble Oil Company, which became Exxon, sent a note to the Petroleum Institute saying, you know, we're causing problems here for the environment. But this denial went on for years, and then it became a strategy in the 90s. And you mention here, in just the three decades since that first climate change denial conference in 1991 or so, during the years that fossil fuels should have faded into obsolescence, because actually both Republicans and Democrats were noticing or acknowledging climate change, more fossil fuels have been pumped into the atmosphere in these three decades than in the entire history of humanity before. And it's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, I knew part of that, but I didn't know the denial went back that far. And I'm also shocked that the emissions of carbon have increased so much in the past 30 years when we should know better.
Yeah. I think that a really just important thing to hold on to is that less people overtly deny climate change now because the fossil fuel industry just shifts its strategies to ways of delaying the phasing out of fossil fuels. And they do so in a form of like false pragmatism. So I remember in 2020, during the worst fire season in California's history at the time, driving towards a fire and seeing quote by Ben Shapiro saying that it's the problem is that it's not about climate change, it's whether we have any solutions that aren't crazy. So it shifts to this false pragmatism to where people might now say, yes, climate change is happening, but we can't implement the solutions. And I think it's just important to really pin it in the fact that we do have solutions. And really any rhetoric that increases fossil fuel emissions or carbon emissions through the use of fossil fuels is in the same category as climate denial. There's nothing pragmatic about anything that is increasing carbon emissions and using fossil fuels instead of phasing out of them. And I think that just as climate denial shifts, that's a really important rhetorical sleight of hand to pay attention to and to just stay rooted in, is that there's nothing pragmatic about increasing carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm. So we do have one question from a listener emailed in. Is indigenous fire knowledge being incorporated into California forest management now, if that forest management is a good term to use? If so, how?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so yes, it's very frequently we focus for good reason on these really large fires that are happening, right? But there should be equal focus and equal celebration of the smaller fires that are happening in local communities that are being lit by people with understandings of the landscapes and understandings of the particular ways and that these particular types of landscapes need certain kinds of fire, right? Because just for some framing for this question, California is one of the most biodiverse landscapes on Earth. And it's also one of the most pyrodiverse landscapes on Earth, meaning it's evolved with fire in a way that very few landscapes on Earth have. And each kind of ecosystem needs a particular kind of fire, right? Just like different ecosystems need different kinds of water. And since for the past 10 to 13,000 years, indigenous people in California have learned how to use this kind of fire and provided it to the landscapes in ways that increase biological diversity and really enhance the health of California. And it's only been in the last couple of centuries that through colonial processes and other really dark historical processes that these fires have been oppressed and suppressed. So that's all just a preface for listeners who weren't aware of that context. So there's different levels of this, but in general, California is one of the few states that has put cultural burning into as an actual legal practice for managing forests, which incorporates indigenous burning it was written by some indigenous fire practitioners in California. And with some other allies and prescribed burn associations. And so there are steps being made in this direction. There's a lot more work to be done. The Forest Service was also manages half of California's land and was making major steps in instituting directives to incorporate indigenous people and burning practices into their forest management plans to put more fire on the ground. This is all getting cut under the Trump administration, not surprisingly.
I was just about to ask about that.
So we can get into that too, but I've been talking for a while now. So.
It's interesting talk. Just want to mention briefly, I just happened to, by coincidence, be up in Humboldt County a week or two ago, and the local weekly newspaper there had a piece about the Northern California Karuk tribe. Which I think the gentleman there was, you mentioned him in your book, Bob Tripp, if I'm remembering his name right. Mm-hmm. But they signed some kind of agreement with the state. Do you know about that, and could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, so I'm not sure about this particular case, but I know that Bill Tripp has been really active with a lot of other people involved in prescribed burns that are really being led by California's indigenous people to get past a lot of the legislative barriers and hurdles to burning. And this has led to legislation that, such as I briefly touched on earlier, such as the legalization of cultural burning, which is burning for purposes beyond just fuels reduction. For purposes such as enhancing certain kinds of plants or foods,
right.
Or cultural materials such as basketry, or different ecosystem services that indigenous people use. And I think that this is it's a different conception of the landscape in California, not as this way that a lot of people in California are historically predisposed to view it as, which is sort of rooted in this colonial view of nature, which is as this like untouched Eden that we should just enjoy. But this is a view of the land as like a cultural artifact or cultural site or part of a cultural exchange that you're actively engaging with. And fire is a way to give a gift to the land if you're burning in the right way, and then the land gives you gifts back. And this is a framework that is often discussed in prescribed burns, especially when indigenous people are helping lead those prescribed burns.
You mentioned the Trump administration a moment ago, and I understand the Trump administration has ordered a 25% increase in lumber production from national forests, including all federal forests here in California. And you write that logging can be good under certain circumstances. What do you think of that Trump's logging push, and what logging practices can be good for forests?
Yeah. I think that the term forest management is a euphemism for so many different things. And with the Trump administration, what forest management should mean is, again, about half of California's land is federal land. So there really is no solution to the fire crisis. So it doesn't involve funding people to do the things that we need to do in that land. And what we need to do in that land is provide it with more fire. And to provide it with more fire, you have to do things to prepare the land for fire, because this land has been really mistreated for several centuries now. Now, so when the Trump administration says that we need more forest management, they then simultaneously cut funding for forest managers. So most of the people I know have been fired from the Forest Service were the people who are doing that forest management. And this is really part of an old right-wing strategy to defund the public sector to make it less efficient, to then justify more cuts to it, and then to justify the privatization of the resources and the land, which is essentially what you see happening with the logging industry now. And this is bad for a couple of reasons, for the forests, of course, but this also just seeds more distrust for the public against the Forest Service. And this is a huge barrier that we're going to have to surmount if we actually want to get a handle on this fire crisis and get back to the kinds of fire we need, because there really is no solution to the crisis in California that doesn't involve the Forest Service, because they manage so much of the land. So it really is a tragedy that the Trump administration is just dancing with these smoke and mirrors and in such bad faith.
So I have to ask here, as we get to the end of our segment, what kind of hope do you have? What ways can we reduce our risk to fire? And just to stop there, what hope do you have? What can people do?
That's a really good question. And I'm actually not going to answer that personally, because I just think that the people I interviewed in this book answer it so much more eloquently than I do. And they deal with it on a more day-to-day basis than I do. And what people at these prescribed burns would say, they're some of the most, the people trying to bring good fire back to California were some of the most hopeful people I've ever been around. And they were working often in areas that were just torched. The places where 90-some% of the national forest had burned. So you're trying to bring good fire back in a forest of skeleton trees. Some of the people I interviewed expressed hope for. It wasn't hope that regaining a relationship with fire would end biodiversity loss or somehow lessen the massive suffering that's going to be growing with climate change. But what it does do, what trying to bring fire back in the right way to California's ecosystems does do, is it brings people together, because you can't really burn alone. So you have to come together as a community. You have to build relationships with the people around you. And you have to build a relationship with the ecosystems you live in and the landscapes that you live in. And you have to learn the history of those landscapes in order to do so. And by learning that history, that also deepens your relationships with other people. Because especially with California's indigenous people, their dispossession in California was very tied to the relinquishing and suppression of fire.
Thank
you. By trying to bring fire back, you're really mending all of these different fractures that have historically formed in society.
Thank you so much. We have to leave it there for now, but it's a fascinating book. I would recommend it. It's When It All Burns, Fighting Fire in a Transformed World by Jordan Thomas, who is our guest tonight, anthropologist and former Los Padres hotshot. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Jordan, and good luck with the rest of your book tour.
Thanks so much for having me on there.
Coming up after the break, State of the Bay host Grace Wan sits down with director Elena Oxman to discuss her debut film. Stay tuned.
This week in This American Life, live inside a family group chat. I want to take you to the beach. When? We're thinking either tomorrow or Monday. We need a watermelon. That's the most important thing. You're making conditions as well? The watermelon is more important than you. And then in this group chat, we watch something big, really big, unfold.
That's This American Life, which airs tomorrow afternoon at 4 here on KALW.
Never miss a beat with the KALW app. Stream your favorite music programs on your schedule anytime, anywhere. Whether you're at home or on the go, the music you love is just a tap away. Download the KALW app now and stay connected to the sounds of the Bay Area.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. San Francisco gets a close-up in director Elena Oxman's debut feature, Outer Lands. It's hard to imagine this tender drama unfolding anywhere other than the city by the bay. With characters struggling to make rent, a non-binary lead, and plenty of fog, it has the elements of a quintessential San Francisco story. The film centers on Cass, who juggles multiple jobs just to get by. When a short-term childcare gig unexpectedly stretches on, they're forced to confront the fragility of their current life, as well as unresolved wounds from the past. Outerlands is an intimate, at times heartbreaking film that feels both rooted in place and profoundly human. We're thrilled to have its director, Elena Oxman, here with us tonight. Welcome to State of the Bay, Elena.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
You know, with films like this, it's always interesting to talk to the director to find out what the genesis of that film is, like what led you to want to make this particular film.
For me, scripts generally start with character, and that was the case here. Cass was a certain kind of person that I was interested in exploring. A lot of parts of Cass are parts of me. I'd made a short film called Lit in 2014 that was kind of a sketch for Outerlands. It was a character sketch of this person who goes out to the Lexington Club, which was this great old bar in the Mission that's not there anymore, but was a real hangout for the queer community. And meet someone, and they end up going on this kind of wandering odyssey around San Francisco at night. And a lot of the themes of Outerlands started to get born in that short film, including this idea of this character who's sort of closed off but searching for connection. And that really became the seed of this character, Cass, and the story behind Outerlands.
And when I think about Outerlands, I think of, you know, the foggy parts of the city. What does Outerlands mean to you?
Well, something about living on the edge, something about loneliness. You know, it's the name of the video game that the character plays about this little astronaut that's kind of wandering in an abandoned planet and trying to find their way back to the mothership. So there's something, I think, about that title that's very evocative. Someone also in a screening recently drew my attention to the word out that's in Outerlands, like out, like queer out. I had actually never thought of that before. But yeah, I think it resonates on a lot of levels.
Cass is hustling to just get by, which feels like such a San Francisco thing, or maybe any city where the cost of living is so high. They're waiting tables, dealing drugs, babysitting for a wealthy family, and they're struggling to keep housing. What resonates with you, and how did you find that center for Cass in dealing with how they're just trying to survive?
That was a situation that I knew many people in. That was and continues to be a common kind of place of trying to make ends meet in a really expensive city where the rents keep going up. There is a kind of metaphorical level, too, of this character that was, again, for me, it often comes just all back to character, this kind of lone wolf who's really, really just trying to do it all by themselves. And a lot of the character's journey is trying to find that connection and that sense of support, both within themselves. And, you know, there's a character who befriends them and ends up being a real support for them. But I think there's definitely this undercurrent of this theme of how society doesn't really have a net to catch people. There's a kind of abandonment going on there that mirrors an abandonment that Cass has in their past, which is the sort of central trauma they're trying to deal with. So I thought that was just interesting how that kind of wider social level plays with the personal level. And ultimately, it's this character who's in this orbit of loneliness trying to find a way out through connection.
You mentioned video games, and they do play a significant role in the film. Were you a gamer growing up? Are you a gamer?
Oh, man, I was hanging on Nintendo, and me and my brothers, we'd be calling up the Nintendo hotline trying to get tips. Uh-huh. I kind of dropped out of video games after that, but that definitely was partly what inspired the idea of this thing that connects them to their past becomes this game that they find in a box that they haven't opened for a while. And there's the visuality, obviously, of video games and this idea of going into another world and this idea of how it's both an escape but also a solace. Mm. And so many people I know who are gamers, it's a place where they really can find some kind of connection. So I liked all those levels of how video games work.
Mm. What do you hope viewers take away from watching Outerlands?
I hope that for anyone who's feeling lonely, that there's a sense of being less alone. That life can be really hard, but we're sort of all going through it together. And there are these possibilities, sometimes in the most unlikely places, for connection and healing. And I think, you know, this idea of coming home to oneself, which is really one of the central themes of the film. Another thing that really was an inspiration for this movie was a point in my life when I was thinking a lot about how we all have these kind of inner kids inside of us and connecting to who we were when we were younger and taking care of those kids and remembering they're there and they hurt sometimes and they get sad and lonely. And if the film can share that message or that inspiration of going back to ask who was I when I was a kid and how was my inner kid doing and all that, that would make me feel like something valuable had been shared. So
You're releasing this film at a time when trans and non-binary communities are facing just increasing hostility across the U.S. I mean, from the administration particularly. How does it feel to be debuting a story like that at this moment?
I'm just so glad we're doing it. We have to keep telling our stories. Like, they can't tell our community who we are, and who trans folks can't be told who they are. You know, they know who they are. And I think just continuing to affirm that, I think art is so important to continue to make it, to come together, especially, you know, I'm so excited for our live screenings. We premiered at, you know, SF Film, but we have two more live screenings in June, and coming together in community to celebrate. All that feels so important always, but especially right now, given this context.
So this is your debut feature, Elena, and you developed it through the SF Films Artist Development Program. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how it helped to shape the film?
Sure. It was SF Films Film House Residency, and I was a resident there for 2 years. It was an amazing experience of being in a cohort of other filmmakers, both documentary and narrative, where there's this really rich exchange of ideas and sharing our work together and presenting works in progress. I was part of a writer's group there where, you know, got to share the script with others and read their work, and just this really amazing Bay Area community film hub that I felt super honored to be a part of. And we also were super grateful to be part of SF Film Invest program, which hooks up projects with people interested in investing in indie film. And it's so rare these days to find places that support and fund indie film. It's different in Europe, right? There's all this government funding for indie film, but like in the US, and especially now as things are being cut left and right, I know so many friends who are having funding cut from their documentary films, but especially in the fiction space, just finding organizations that support what we do. So I'm just have so much gratitude to SF Film.
It is hard to break into this industry, and I'm curious if you have advice for an aspiring filmmaker, especially, you know, women who are trying to tell stories that are not about superheroes and don't have 15 sequels built or baked into them. How do you start off in this field?
Well, first of all, I'd say if you want to tell something other than superhero movies, that's actually great news, because that way, way cheaper. You know, that's my biggest advice is that it really is about the vision and the story. I mean, these days, the technology is a lot easier than it's ever been. And I really just would encourage starting with shorts, starting small, don't worry about anything flashy, but really honing the essence of what is it that you want to say and the authenticity of that and just letting that guide you.
I do like an indie film because I don't have to learn about what happened, you know, in the 17 other films that are in that universe. Are you working on anything new right now, Elena, that you could share with us?
Yeah, I have a couple scripts in development, very different from Outerlands. I'm originally from the East Coast, so both of them are set out there, one in New Hampshire and one in Vermont, and one's a story about a mother-son. But it overlaps with Outerlands in the way that there's a queer character in it, and it's really about a woman in middle age kind of coming into her own. And then the other one is an adaptation of a Chekhov short story. So,
I'm into both.
Yeah.
For our listeners who want to catch Outerlands, what's the best way for them to see it?
So there's two opportunities in June. On June 13th, we're the opening night film of California Films Pride Week. Ooh. So that's going to be at the San Rafael Theater. And then June 22nd, we're playing in Frameline at 6 p.m. at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland.
Both sound fun. Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. It's such a great movie. Elena Oxman, thanks so much for joining us and talking about Outerlands here on State of the Bay.
The button. That's State of the Bay this week. Big thanks to all of our guests this evening. Next Monday at 6, we'll hear from political analyst and writer Lincoln A. Mitchell about his new book, 3 Years Our Mayor, the Making of Modern San Francisco. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything here tonight, please let us know. Email us anytime at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Chris Nooney. The last segment was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and Tarek Ansari was our board operator and engineer in studio tonight. I'm Eric Jansen. Good night, and thanks for listening.